A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. So, I was asking in a previous episode about the concept of an all-in monthly dining experience. If someone has tried the concept of, instead of having, you know, a la carte restaurants, I mentioned when I was a student in London, I decided to just give up on buying groceries and eat in a vegetarian buffet every day under the guise of hopefully getting my nutritional requirements. And it was pretty great. And I was just thinking, why doesn't this exist as like a thing that if you take, you know, however much you're spending on groceries per week, I'm talking specifically about city centre living, but I guess could be applied anywhere. You know, you've got a bunch of people living in a place where you might not have so much space to cook. I personally don't like cooking in cramped kitchens at all. And let's come together and set up something that you have your membership, essentially a meal plan, and you can just eat whenever you feel like it, except not for students, for like, you know, real people with jobs. I don't know if that exists or someone's tried that concept, but I remember mentioning to I was chatting with a friend a while back. We were both saying how fun this would be. We were sitting in a Wetherspoons, which is a chain of British pubs that is kind of known for operating no-frills establishments. And we were having our, you know, our fish and chips and our ale, and thinking about, my friend floated the concept of a Wetherspoons pub that you could live in. Bear with me just for 1 second. Take your average Wetherspoons. It's this kind of two-story bar, and they have, you know, affordable drinks, and they have affordable food. You've got two of your human needs covered there. Now imagine if you added to that a co-working space. And imagine if you added to that co-working space dormitories or some kind of rental accommodation. And imagine if you added on top of that a gym to keep fit, a social space, and a supermarket. And you constructed this kind of mega building that essentially provided everything you needed under one roof, such that you could subscribe or rent to this unified living model and perhaps never have to leave the building. Now, I'm not saying you would never leave the building or that humans would be happy in such an arrangement, but the concept we thought was intriguing. We called this Weather Life. It was what we viewed as a natural fork on the Wetherspoons concept. And we wrote a very serious email to Wetherspoons head office saying that if they'd like to discuss this, what we saw as the natural extension of the Wetherspoons concept, that they had two very eager and entrepreneurial people who would love to chat with them. Sadly, we never heard back from Wetherspoons, but I remain interested in the idea. This is one of those things that sounds very studentish, you know? I mean, who would want this? It's not like actual functional humans would want to never leave a building, but there are some odd bods out there for whom this actually sounds great. Imagine living in a building where you had all your friends, a supermarket, a gym, a pub, you know, a few restaurants. That would be pretty cool, no? I mean, I totally wouldn't do this myself, but someone who isn't me might think that sounds like a great proposition. Herman and Corin, let's talk about the concept of unified building living, a single subscription model for all your needs. Has anyone actually done this? What is it called? And do the people there just become kind of live-in building recluses, or what's it actually like? Over to you.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about the idea of an all-in-one living building. Not just a dorm, not just a co-living space, but something that covers food, shelter, social life, work, and exercise under one roof on a single subscription. He and a friend once tried to pitch this to Wetherspoons, the British pub chain, and called it Weatherlife. The question is, has anyone actually done this? What's it called? And do the people living there just become recluses who never leave the building?
This is one of those ideas that sounds like a student fever dream until you realize there are actual companies burning through hundreds of millions of dollars trying to make it work right now. The term you want is co-living, but the all-inclusive, everything, under one roof version is really an extreme end of it, what some developers call integrated living or vertical villages. The closest real-world example I can think of is a company called Common, which started in Brooklyn and expanded to multiple cities. They offered furnished apartments with utilities, cleaning, household supplies, and community events bundled into one monthly payment. But they never quite got to the supermarket and pub and gym all in the same building.
They got the housing and the Wi-Fi and the awkward rooftop mixes, but stopped short of the full Weatherlight vision.
And worth noting, Common ran into serious trouble. They were acquired by a German company called Hobbit in early 2023, and by late 2024 they'd pulled out of most of their U. The economics are brutal.
The economics of bundling everything, or the economics of being a landlord?
Both, but especially the bundling. When you're just a landlord, you collect rent and you're done. When you're providing food and gym access and co-working and cleaning and social programming, your operating costs are astronomical, and the margin on rent gets eaten alive. There's a reason hotels charge what they charge, and even they don't typically include three meals a day.
Although, and this is where the Weatherspoon's connection gets interesting, hotels are basically the Weatherlife model for short stays. You've got a room, there's a restaurant downstairs, maybe a bar, probably a gym if it's a decent one, sometimes a business center that doubles as a co-working space. You could, in theory, check into a residence inn and just never check out.
People do that. It's not common, but there's a small subculture of long-term hotel living. Some extended stay hotels have guests who've been there for years. The difference is you're paying a premium for daily housekeeping and a front desk, which isn't what the Weatherlife idea is about. The Weatherlife pitch is affordability through bundling. Take what you'd spend on rent and groceries and a gym membership and a co-working desk and combine it into one lower price. The problem is that math almost never works unless you're cutting corners somewhere.
Like Weatherspoons does.
Weatherspoons is the budget, airline version of a pub. No music, standardized layouts, bulk purchasing, fast table turnover, and they famously buy near-expiry beer stock from breweries at a discount and pass the savings on. That's their whole thing. The question is whether you can apply that model to housing without creating something dystopian.
The Weatherspoons of living. A no-frills existence where the carpet is patent-dyed stains. You can get a pint for £2.50, and your bedroom is directly above the bar.
Honestly, that's the version of this that might actually be viable. Not fancy co-living with curated events and mid-century modern furniture, but genuinely affordable, no frills, everything you need. Housing. The problem is zoning and building codes. You can't just stack a pub, a supermarket, a gym, a co-working space, and apartments in one building in most cities. Each of those uses has different fire codes, different accessibility requirements, different parking minimums. The regulatory friction is enormous.
The idea dies not because people wouldn't want it, but because City Hall says you can't have a bar directly underneath where people sleep.
Which is funny, because that's exactly how cities used to work. The classic main street had shops on the ground floor and apartments above. The pub was on the corner and people lived upstairs. Mixed use isn't new. It's how we built everything before zoning codes separated uses in the early 20th century. The Weatherlife idea is basically pre-zoning urbanism with a subscription pricing model.
We invented zoning to stop the butcher from living above the bakery, and now we're trying to reinvent the butcher above the bakery but with an app.
A venture capital deck. But let me come back to something you said earlier about the vegetarian buffet. Daniel's original experiment, giving up groceries and eating every meal at a single buffet, that's actually the purest version of the all-in dining subscription. And it does exist, it's just not called that.
What's it called?
University dining halls. The subscription restaurant model works fine when you have a captive audience. Students on a campus, employees in an office park, patients in a hospital. It's when you try to offer it to the general public that the economics fall apart. Because you can't predict demand, you can't guarantee volume, and you get hit with adverse selection. The people who sign up are the ones who eat the most.
The buffet's worst nightmare. A subscription where your best customers are the ones who cost you the most money.
It's the gym membership problem inverted. Gyms make money because most members never show up. A restaurant subscription loses money because the members who sign up are exactly the ones who will eat 3 meals a day, 7 days a week. The only way to make it work is to price it high enough that the heavy users are subsidized by the light users, but at that price point, the light users don't sign up. Classic adverse selection spiral.
The all-in dining subscription only works when people don't have a choice. Students, employees, hospital patients. The minute it's voluntary, the economics invert.
There was a startup called MealPal that tried something adjacent. A lunch subscription where you pre-ordered from participating restaurants, and they're still around, but they pivoted hard away from the all-you-can-eat model. It's now basically a discount pre-order platform. The unit economics of feeding people on a subscription basis are just punishingly difficult.
Which brings us back to the Weatherlife pitch. If the dining part alone is hard, bundling dining plus housing plus co-working plus gym plus gym plus supermarket is, what, 4 times as hard?
More than 4, because the failures compound. If the restaurant loses money, and the gym loses money, and the co-working space loses money, you can't just cross-subsidize from the housing revenue forever. Rent only goes so high before people decide to just rent a regular apartment and eat at normal restaurants.
Has anyone actually pulled off the full vision? A single building where you pay 1 monthly fee and get a place to sleep, eat, work, exercise, and socialize.
The closest thing that actually exists and is financially solvent is probably the private members club model, Soho House, for instance. You pay an annual membership fee and you get access to their spaces, restaurants, bars, co-working areas, gyms, sometimes even hotel rooms. They don't typically include housing in the membership itself, but some locations have bedrooms you can book. It's not the Weatherlife model, but it's the same psychological appeal. One membership, one ecosystem, one identity.
The Soho House of budget living.
I would join Weatherspoon's house, but this is where the class dimension gets interesting. The premium version of this idea exists and thrives. Soho House, members clubs, luxury co-living buildings in Manhattan and London that charge $5,000 a month for a studio with a shared gym and a rooftop. The budget version doesn't exist, and that's not an accident. The economics are harder at the low end because your margins are thinner and your customers are more price sensitive. You can't charge enough to cover the cost of all those amenities, so you either cut the amenities or raise the price, and either way you lose the value proposition.
We've got luxury Weatherlife for rich people, and we've got university dining halls for students, and in between there's a vast empty space where the actual interesting idea lives and can't survive.
There's one exception worth noting. In some parts of Asia, particularly in dense urban areas, you see something closer to the all-in-one model. There are residential towers in Tokyo and Singapore and Hong Kong that have retail on the lower floors, food courts, gyms, even medical clinics, all in the same building. You don't pay one subscription, you pay rent, plus you buy your food and services separately, but the physical integration is there. The building really does contain most of what you need for daily life.
The physical bundling works. It's the financial bundling that's the hard part.
And there's a really interesting case study here. In 2023, a company called Flow, this is Adam Neumann's post-WeWork venture, raised $350 million from Andreessen Horowitz to do basically a branded residential experience. They bought apartment buildings and planned to offer community, services, events, a sense of belonging. The details were always vague, which is classic Neumann. But the idea was clearly in this space, not quite Weatherlife, but a subscription, adjacent living experience.
The man who looked at the office and said, "What if this was a kombucha bar?" and then raised billions of dollars.
Then did it again with housing. Flow is still operating, but it's been remarkably quiet for a company that raised that much money. They have properties in a few cities, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Atlanta, Nashville, but there's no public evidence they've cracked the model. It's basically a landlord with a brand strategy.
The WeWork of apartments. What could go wrong?
The WeWork comparison is actually instructive because WeWork's whole pitch was that they weren't just renting desks. They were selling community, culture, a way of life. And when the economics got exposed, it turned out they were just a middleman in a long-term lease arbitrage game. The Weatherlife risk is the same. It's easy to promise a lifestyle, but the balance sheet doesn't care about vibes.
Let me ask the other part of the prompt. Assuming someone did build this, the full Weatherlife Tower, pub on the ground floor, supermarket on 2, co-working on 3, gym on 4, apartments above. What happens to the people who live there? Do they become recluses?
There's actually some research on this from the co-living industry, and the answer is nuanced. People in well-designed co-living buildings tend to report higher social satisfaction than people in conventional apartments because the design forces casual interaction, shared kitchens, communal dining, common areas you actually want to spend time in. But they don't stay inside. Most residents still go out for work, for entertainment, for variety. The building becomes a social home base, not a total institution.
A total institution! That's the phrase I was circling. The Weatherlife Tower is a friendly opt-in panopticon.
The sociologist Irving Goffman coined the term total institution for places like prisons, military barracks, monasteries, and mental hospitals. Places where people sleep, work, eat, and socialize in the same setting, under the same authority, with the same people on a fixed schedule. And the Weatherlife idea, if you squint, does share some of those features. But the crucial difference is that it's voluntary. You can leave. You're paying for it. That changes the psychology entirely.
Monasteries are voluntary too, and people choose them. But nobody would mistake a monastery for a consumer lifestyle product.
Although, and this is where I want to push back a little, there is a long history of intentional communities that are essentially the Weatherlife model on a smaller scale. The kibbutz movement in Israel, for instance. Communal dining, shared facilities, housing provided, work organized collectively. At its peak in the mid-20th century, the kibbutz was exactly this, one unified living model where you didn't pay for individual services because everything was pooled.
Right, but the kibbutz was built on ideology and shared purpose, not on a value proposition about saving money on groceries. People joined a kibbutz because they believed in collective living, not because the fish and chips were affordable.
That's the thing about Weatherlife. It's an idea that only makes sense if you strip out the ideology and treat it as a consumer product. But the kind of commitment required, living, eating, working, socializing all in one building with the same people, might actually need some kind of shared purpose or identity to hold it together. Otherwise, you're just in a very efficient, very lonely box.
The prompt mentions sitting in a Weatherspoons with a friend, having fish and chips and ale, and that being the spark. There's something about that image. Two people in a cheap pub, enjoying themselves, thinking about how nice it would be if they didn't have to leave. The fantasy is not about efficiency. It's about extending that moment indefinitely. The pub as the center of life.
The pub as the third place, except elevated to the first place. You live there now.
The third place, the sociologist Ray Oldenburg's term for somewhere that isn't home and isn't work, where you go for community. The whole Weatherlife idea collapses the three places into one building, home, work, and social life, all under one roof, which is either a dream of ultimate convenience or a nightmare of never getting away from your coworkers.
It depends entirely on whether you like the people. If your neighbors are your friends, it's great. If your neighbor is someone who microwaves fish at 2 in the morning and has strong opinions about the shared gym equipment, it's a special kind of purgatory.
The co-living version of a bad roommate, except you also see them at the pub and the supermarket and the co-working desk. There's no escape.
That's the unspoken assumption in the Weatherlife pitch, that the people would be good, that the community would be pleasant. And that's not a design problem, it's a curation problem. The only way to guarantee good neighbors is to select for them, and the moment you start selecting, you're no longer a public accommodation. You're a private club.
Which brings us back to Soho House. The premium version of this works because they vet their members. The budget version can't vet, because the whole point is to be open and affordable. So you get the full spectrum of humanity, including the people you moved into a unified living building specifically to avoid.
There's a famous example from the history of company towns. Pullman, Illinois, built by the Pullman Palace Car Company in the 1880s. George Pullman built an entire town for his workers. Housing, stores, a church, a library, a theater, everything under one corporate roof. And it was beautiful, well-designed, clean. And the workers hated it, because Pullman charged market-rate rent, controlled every aspect of life, and fired anyone who complained. The Pullman strike of 1894 was one of the most violent labor conflicts in American history.
The Weatherlife pitch. But your landlord is also your boss, and your grocer, and your bartender.
That's the control problem. When one entity provides everything, that entity has enormous power over your life. If the subscription price goes up, you can't just switch grocers, you have to move. If the food quality declines, you can't just eat somewhere else without effectively paying twice. The convenience of bundling is also the vulnerability of bundling.
What's the version of this that actually works? Not the luxury version, not the student version, not the company town dystopia. Is there a middle ground?
I think the middle ground is something we already have and don't really name. It's the dense, mixed-use urban neighborhood where you happen to live above a grocery store, two doors down from a gym, around the corner from a pub, and your co-working space is a 10-minute walk. You pay for each separately, but the physical experience is basically the Weta Life vision. The difference is that the services are independently owned and operated, so no single entity controls everything, and you can switch providers without moving.
The Weta Life vision minus the subscription. All the convenience, none of the lock-in.
And this is actually the direction a lot of urban development is going. The 15-minute city concept, everything you need within a 15-minute walk or bike ride, is essentially distributed Weta Life. You get the lifestyle benefits without the single provider risk. The trade-off is that you don't get the unified billing and the curated community, but you also don't get the control and the vulnerability.
The 15-minute city has Weta Life without the weather spoons.
Or Weta Life as the 15-minute city with a single landlord and a bulk discount on lauder. I think the honest answer to the prompt is that the full subscription model doesn't exist at scale for good reasons, but pieces of it exist all over the place. And the physical integration, living on top of a pub, above a supermarket, next to a gym, is not only possible, it's how most of the world's great cities already work.
Daniel and his friend weren't wrong to pitch it. They were just trying to financialize something that already exists organically.
Which is a very startup thing to do. Identify something people already do for free, wrap it in a subscription, call it disruption. But I will say this, the fact that Weatherspoons never responded is probably a good thing. The people who actually try to build these things tend to lose a lot of money and make their residents miserable.
The silence from Weatherspoon's head office was the kindest possible answer.
A non-reply is the most merciful rejection in business. It means someone read the email, thought about it for 30 seconds, and decided not to ruin your life by saying yes.
I'm now imagining the alternate timeline where Weatherspoons did say yes. Two eager entrepreneurs get a meeting, pitch Weta Life, and somehow convince a pub chain to become a residential developer. What happens next?
They'd run headfirst into the thing I mentioned earlier, the regulatory wall. In the UK, converting a pub into mixed-use residential would trigger planning permission reviews, building regulations for change of use, fire safety requirements for sleeping accommodations above a licensed premises, accessibility requirements, possibly a Section 106 agreement requiring affordable housing contributions. The idea that a pub chain could just add dormitories and a supermarket is, from a regulatory standpoint, science fiction.
From a vibe standpoint, compelling.
From a vibe standpoint, I would live there tomorrow. A Weatherspoons with bedrooms upstairs, a Tesco Express on the ground floor, a gym in the basement, and a co-working space where the pool tables used to be. The carpet would be the same in every location. You'd always know where you were.
The Weatherspoons carpet has a unifying design language. Each location has a unique carpet pattern. They're actually locally commissioned. The Weta Life Tower would need its own carpet. Something that says welcome home, but also 2 pints for £6.
That's the real missed opportunity. The Weta Life carpet, the Weta Life app, the Weta Life meal plan with a full English breakfast included every morning. It's all there, it's just illegal and unprofitable.
The two horsemen of startup failure, illegal and unprofitable.
There's actually one more example I want to bring up, because it's the closest thing to a real-world Weta Life that actually operated. There's a building in Shinjuku, Tokyo, called the Nakagin Capsule Tower. Built in 1972, it was a stack of prefabricated concrete capsules, each one a tiny apartment with a bed, a desk, a bathroom pod, and a round window. The idea was that these capsules could be replaced individually as they aged. And the tower was designed for what the architect, Kisho Kurokawa, called metabolic architecture, buildings that grow and change like living organisms. The capsules were meant for businessmen who needed a place to sleep in the city during the week. It wasn't a subscription, but it was exactly the kind of compact, everything-you-need, no-frills urban living unit that the Weatherlife idea points toward.
What happened to it?
It fell apart. The capsules were never replaced because the replacement system was too expensive. The building deteriorated for decades. Residents complained about mold, cramped conditions, and the fact that the hot water system kept breaking. It became a landmark. Architects loved it, photographers loved it, tourists loved it, but living there was apparently pretty miserable by the end. It was finally demolished in 2022.
Even the visionary version of this, designed by a famous architect, ended up as a moldy box with no hot water. The Weatherlife trajectory.
The metabolic architecture dream collided with the reality of maintenance costs and human comfort, which is basically the whole story of ambitious housing ideas in one building.
Yet people still want it. The prompt is evidence of that. Two people sitting in a pub, enjoying themselves, thinking, "What if this was my whole life?" There's something appealing about the fantasy. Even if the reality would be damp carpets and passive-aggressive notes about the shared microwave.
I think the appeal is real and worth taking seriously, even if the execution is nearly impossible. The fantasy of Weatherlife is the fantasy of simplicity. One bill, one place, one community. No commute, no decisions about where to eat, no friction between the different parts of your day. That's a genuine human desire. It's why monasteries exist. It's why college is, for a lot of people, the happiest time of their lives. It's why cruise ships are a multi-billion dollar industry.
A cruise ship? That's the Weatherlife model that actually works.
A cruise ship is exactly this. You pay one price, you get a room, all meals, entertainment, a gym, social spaces, sometimes co-working facilities. You're in a floating building with everything you need, and people love it. The cruise industry served over 30 million passengers in 2019 before the pandemic, and it's been rebounding since. The demand for the all-inclusive, everything, under one roof experience is clearly there.
The Weatherlife idea isn't wrong, it's just been built on water instead of land. The physics make it work. You can't leave the ship, so the captive audience problem solves itself. On land, people can just walk out the front door.
The cruise ship has another advantage. The staff aren't your neighbors. The people serving you food and cleaning your room are employees, not fellow residents. That changes the social dynamic enormously. In a Weatherlife building, who cleans the shared kitchen? Who stocks the supermarket? If the answer is the residents themselves, you've got a co-op with a governance problem. If the answer is paid staff, your subscription just got more expensive.
The Weatherlife Co-op. A building full of people who all thought they were signing up for convenience and instead got a part-time job managing inventory for the building pub.
Someone has to order the near-expiry beer stock. That's a skill set.
I'd be good at that, actually. I have opinions about beer inventory.
You'd be the beverage coordinator. I'd handle the gym equipment maintenance. Daniel can manage the co-working space. We're practically halfway to a business plan.
We're not emailing Weatherspoons.
The email has already been sent. The silence is our answer.
So, the Weatherlife dream lives on in the space between what people want and what the world will let them have. The all-in-one building where you never need to leave, except you absolutely would leave, because the pub downstairs would start to feel like your living room, and your living room would start to feel like the pub, and eventually you'd need to see a tree that isn't in the building's atrium.
The atrium tree. The one piece of nature in the Weatherlife Tower, strategically placed next to the co-working desk so you can feel connected to the natural world while you take a Zoom call.
A single ficus, heroically representing the entire outdoors.
I think the final thing to say here is that the Weatherlife idea is a beautiful thought experiment that reveals something real about what people want. Simplicity, community, convenience, and also reveals why those things are hard to bundle into a product. The things that make life good don't scale well. A good pub, a good gym, a good supermarket, a good apartment. Each of these is hard enough to do well on its own. Bundling them into one subscription doesn't make them easier to deliver. It just means that when one of them fails, they all feel like they're failing together.
The single point of failure problem. In a normal life, if your gym is bad, you switch gyms. In Weatherlife, if the gym is bad, your entire living situation is compromised.
That's the trade-off, convenience versus resilience. The Weatherlife pitch assumes you want maximum convenience, but people also want control and variety and the ability to walk away from a bad experience without walking away from their home.
The verdict on Weatherlife? It exists in fragments. It exists on cruise ships. It exists in university dining halls and luxury co-living buildings and the Nakagin capsule tower. But the full vision, affordable, all-in-one, subscription-based, pub-centered living, remains a beautiful email in a Weatherspoon's inbox, unanswered.
Perhaps that's where it belongs, but I'll say this. If someone does crack the model, if someone figures out the zoning, the unit economics, the community curation, the maintenance, the beer inventory, they'll have built something new. And I'll be the first to sign up, assuming the pub has good ale.
The Weatherlife Tower. Come for the affordable housing. Stay, because you've forgotten how doors work.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1932, New Zealand astronomer Charles Gifford was widely credited with discovering an unusual concentration of meteorite fragments on the Chatham Islands, and the find was named the Gifford Field. It was later determined that what he'd actually discovered was the scattered debris of a failed weather balloon experiment launched by a German research team that had drifted thousands of miles off course, and the metal fragments he'd mistaken for meteorites were mostly bits of a barometer casing.
A barometer casing? The Chatham Islands' contribution to space science.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back next time with another prompt and another deep dive into whatever strange corner of the world Daniel's curiosity has wandered into. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Corn.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.